And now, The Mentors Radio, one of the most popular and unique shows on the air today. Here each week, remarkable CEOs and leaders, including host Tom Laurie and Dan Hesse, and their guest will mentor you, challenging your thinking about life and work. Sought after for their ethical leadership and advice, and for helping others succeed throughout their careers, now these same CEOs, the mentors, want to help you achieve your highest level of profitability, success, and personal fulfillment in life, at work, and in business. Learn more and check out the show notes at thementorsradio.com. That's thementorsradio.com. And now, here is your mentor.
Welcome, I'm your host, Dan Hesse. Today's guest is Ursula Burns, chairwoman of Teneo and founding partner of private equity company Integrum Holdings. But she's best known for serving as chairwoman and CEO of Xerox during a 36-year career where she became the first Black female CEO of a Fortune 500 company. In addition, Ursula serves on several private company boards while also providing leadership counsel to several community, educational, and nonprofit organizations, including the Ford Foundation, the MIT Corporation, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Mayo Clinic, among others. President Obama appointed her to lead the White House National Program on STEM, and she served as chair of the President's Export Council. Since February 2022, she has been vice chair of the U.S. Department of Commerce's Advisory Council on Supply Chain Competitiveness. Ursula holds a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Columbia and a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from NYU. She's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Royal Academy of Engineering. Welcome, Ursula.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here, Dan.
Well, I'm so glad that you are here. And if our listeners want to read a really inspiring story, I highly recommend they read your memoir, Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. So you grew up in the projects of Manhattan, raised by a single mother who was an immigrant from Panama, who was not a U.S. citizen, though she had a green card. And I think you estimated she was a very hard worker, but she made only $4,400 a year. But she found a way to send you and your siblings to Catholic school. Tell us a little bit about Olga Burns.
My mother was this fairly ordinary, extraordinary person. So what do I mean by that? I mean, she was like many, many poor single mothers, most of the single parents in the neighborhood I was in were women. She worked hard. She had a high school diploma, very few additional marketable skills. She was a hustler, meaning she figured out a way to keep her children safe and centered, safe and centered. And she would say to us things like, you know, I only have three assets in the world. And her entire life is focused on assuring that these assets stay safe and centered. And the assets were my brother, my sister, and I. And as I got older, I realized just how amazing the accomplishments of this woman was. I literally had food on the table. We all did every night. Not graceful, many nights not with meat, but always tasty. We had a very organized house in one of the worst blocks, worst neighborhoods you could imagine. But walk into our house, and there was a structure, there was safety, there was discipline, there were high expectations. She focused on education to the point where all of her additional money, she bartered for things. We got medical care by my mother cleaning the office of the doctor and the dentist. That's how literally we got the health care. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we were late for tuition. You name it, but it was all about her three kids, and she was not confused. She died really young. She died when she was 49 and I was 25. And, you know, the story of that is you know, a little bit typical of the poor side of America, not enough access to health care, not enough access to preventative problems, because what she died of was something that if we caught it early, she probably could have lived. But the whole process here and the whole point of this story was that she was exceptional in a very ordinary way. She was just really focused on us and our kids and her kids.
She really sounds exceptional. Yeah. Well, using a baseball analogy, one could say that, you know, I was born on third base, being white, male, having middle-class parents who both went to college. I think it was a high school counselor that, using another baseball analogy, said you had three strikes against you, being female, Black, and poor. Where did you kind of find the strength to leave the where, you're using your book's title, behind, to become who you are?
Yeah, the story of that, it actually happened in grade school. It was when I was about 7 years old. So it was even more frightening, given where I, you know, the age I was, where a priest, it was a high level priest. I went to all girl high school, Catholic, and I went to a Catholic grade school, mixed sex Catholic grade school. And the counselor came in, he was doing a speech. It was something, I got selected to read one of the questions to this person. And at the end, we got to walk by and shake his hand, the people who were selected for to read the things. And he said, "Oh my, your question is so wonderful. Thank you." He said, "You know, and you seem very bright. And, you know, the only problem," he didn't say it this way, but he didn't say the only problem. "You seem so bright. You know, you're going to have to kind of get over some things. You know, you're poor, you're Black, and you're a girl." And I remember leaving that and kind of forgetting it, not even thinking about it when I left. I remember when I went home a couple of days later, I told it to my mom, and she was, in her inevitable way of being just very practical, she said to me, for the first time I heard this, one of her many little glibs was, "Don't worry about it, Max. My name is Ursula Maxine Burns," and she called me Maxine, and they shortened it to Max. She said, "Don't worry about it, Max. The world doesn't happen to you. You have to happen to the world." What I ended up learning was that people's thoughts, while important and having an impact on me, were less important and had less of an impact than what I thought and what I did. So, and this was my mother, I tell you, she was always a pusher. I would say, she said, "You got to go to college. We have to go to college. So, you know, you have to prepare for college." And I would always say to her, "How the hell are we going to pay for college?" And she said, "Don't worry about that. That's my job. You worry about what your job is." And this whole thing about moving forward, about taking control of my life, doing what I can do for myself, understanding and remembering that I always have a brother and sister that are part of my life that I have to take care of. They, the same for me. We were all raised with this idea that things are not great at this moment, but they're not horrible either. I mean, we're not living in a war-torn country. We're eating every day. We were going to a reasonable school. But please remember that if you allow people to kind of chart your path and set your limits, we know exactly where you're going to end up, right? We're going to end up in a place that at that time, and still largely today, that America defines for a Black woman, which is not a lot of possibilities, and in service of others in a negative way all the time. So my mother was just this whole thing about where you are was a big theme of my mother. It's like, that's not who you are. Who you are is significantly more basic, and it's actually significantly more important. You can't get stuck in the fact that today you're rich and famous, or today you're not rich and famous. You have to literally make sure you understand that all of that stuff is not who you are, right? Who you are is in your soul, in your heart. And my mother would say to me all the time, as the title says, where you are is not who you are. Remember that when you're rich and famous. She said, remember that when you're rich and famous. My mother had no idea, Dan, what rich and famous meant. My mother had no, you know, nowadays you say you can look it up in who's rich and famous. You can look it up on the internet. We had no internet then. There was nothing. My mother came from Panama on a boat here. She saw the neighborhood she was from in Panama and the neighborhood we lived in. That was it. And in those two places, you didn't see rich and famous at all. But she realized that with effort and her giving us a good foundation, we could get there. But she didn't want us to get there and forget the fact that there still counts on us being, you know, where we came from. It still counts on our moral value, our, you know, just our fortuitousness, our dedication, and understanding that literally if we make it on the shoulders of many, many people, and that comes out a lot in the book. The whole book is about the fact that there were hundreds of people, some of them I didn't even know, who helped me in every aspect of life. Some of them are famous, some of them are not, but without that help, I would never have been able to get out of where I was.
We'll be back in a few minutes with our guest mentor, Ursula Burns. Go to our website, thementorsradio.com, and click on List of Shows to listen to past guests. This is Dan Hesse, and you are listening to The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm with former Xerox CEO Ursula Burns. Remember, you can also listen to this show or any previous show via podcast on Apple, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart, or Stitcher on any device at any time. So, Ursula, what made you choose engineering as your college major, and how did it feel not only being a woman, but being a Black woman in a white male-dominated field?
Engineering was totally and completely by luck. And one of the things I work for a lot now is to make sure that luck is not the way that engineers are found, that we actually have some kind of a pathway to getting more and more people engaged in engineering. But I literally figured it out when I was in high school, and I was looking for, in the Barron's book of colleges and universities, there's a section that describes what fields pay the most money after 4 years. And the number one field was chemical engineering. And literally, I decided to become a chemical engineer because I wanted to make enough money to make my mother's life a little bit easier right after I graduated from college. And after 4 years, chemical engineering was it. Needless to say, because I became a mechanical engineer, I didn't do chemical engineering. I found that I was horrible at chemistry, didn't like it, and wasn't good at it. And that by the time I got into school to study chemical engineering, I could change my major, because I was a freshman, into something else. And fortunately, a counselor told me, you don't have to quit. I thought I had to quit school to change majors. She said, no, you don't have to quit school. Just declare another major. You're a freshman. You haven't taken anything yet. And I was really good at math. I was not necessarily as well trained as some of the people who went to Bronx Science or Stuyvesant or those kind of schools, because my school was an all-girl Catholic school, and they spent as much time on religion as they did on mathematics. But it was a school that taught me how to read, how to learn, how to discern things. You know, it was just a great fundamental education place. And so what I didn't have in math and science, I was able to pick up relatively quickly because I was taught to learn.
So why'd you choose Xerox as your first
another employer? The beginning of my life is all about these like lucky roles. Luck is, you know, for the people who are prepared, they all say, but literally I had this great mother. I literally had, when she sent me to 12 years of grade school, high school, of the best education she could possibly afford, which was not the best education available, but is the best she can afford. From that point, I went to college and studied a field that was perfect for me, that I kind of happened into. And then when I was a junior in college, this company came on campus. You know, they always come on campus, Bell Labs, you know, all these companies. This company came on campus, and they came on campus with a guy named Howard Adams, who ran a program called GEM. It was there to push Black college students to get their master's degrees. That was the whole point. Because at that point, right, we were learning that some Black kids were going to college, and what happened is that companies would peel them off. They would get 4 years and go straight to work. This GEM program said that the real degree is your master's degree. You should at least get that, dedicate your time. You know, it's only another year or two, if that's how long it takes, and do it. And so I absolutely got this guy, Howard Adams, and Xerox came to me and said, grades are good, everything is great. I'll give you a job over the summer. You work for us, you come to school, during your breaks, we'll give you a job. We give you a little stipend, you get your degree, you have 2 years to do it. And then basically at that point, you leave. I didn't even have to go to Xerox. I could have just gone anywhere. Fortunately, I worked at Xerox during the summers as part of my GEM fellowship, and I loved it. It was just the perfect place. And it was just a great place to work. I had great bosses. We had a whole bunch of summer engineers who they put together and, you know, in dorms, and it was perfect. And I basically never left. I walked into Xerox thinking that I would leave after a couple of years because it was upstate. And I ended up staying there almost 40 years. It was luck. I didn't know anything about this spam thing that did copying. You know, I thought I was going to go to Electric Boat Company, General Dynamics Electric Boat. That was my dream, to go work on submarines. And I didn't get anywhere near it. I went to work on copying machines, of all things. But it was fun. It was great.
Well, you mentioned luck. My last guest mentor was David Rubenstein, and he wrote a book about, you know, great leaders. And he listed 13 qualities, and number one was luck, which is interesting. This being the Mentors Radio, I'm struck by the number of mentors that you give a lot of credit to in your book for, you know, your ascent and your development. And the first was Waylon Hicks, who I guess noticed you fairly early. What did he notice about you that he liked, and what did you learn from him?
Yeah, I call Waylon Hicks Mr. Hustle. Waylon always worked unbelievably hard, visibly hard. I mean, there were very few light moments. I mean, there were personal light moments, but in work, it was all about the customer, the employee, the shareholder. He was a hustler. He never took advantage of anything. If it was given to him, he double and triple checked it. He was just one of these guys. He taught me about this idea that you know, your troops get to sleep before you sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, your troops get to eat before you eat. As a leader, it's really important that you show what you want people to emulate. So you don't just talk it, you do it. He's very good, not very flexible guy, actually different politics than me. It's amazing that we even got along at all, because I mean, he's, you know, Midwestern white guy. I'm an urban conservative white guy. I'm an urban, very liberal black girl. We hit it off. We argued about everything. But at the core of this guy was somebody who was willing to listen and was willing to work for a better outcome. And that he taught me that in spades.
Well, you mentioned some other key mentors, Paul Allaire, Anne Mulcahy, and a board member, Vernon Jordan. Briefly, what you learned from them?
I learned grace from Paul. He was a lot different than Waylon, as intense, but showed it very differently. Very quiet, extremely thoughtful man. I loved things clearly, obviously, and showed that he loved things like the ballet outside of work. He literally was able to meld these two things together. He was just the nicest man. Of all of the people who I worked for, he's probably the nicest person I've ever worked for. And Anne was actually, I call her literally the highest EQ person I have ever met, even to this day. She gets how people would react to things. Anne can get you to do something that you a minute ago said you would not do. I never do that, because she has such a tune on what drives you that she can absolutely twist it, not manipulate, but twist this thing to make sure that you understand clearly how good this is for you as well as the other person. And Vernon was probably the most impactful mentor. First of all, he's bigger than life. He had access that was unbelievable to anybody. I mean, if you want to talk to them, either he knew them or he could find somebody who knew them he was just an amazing guy that way. But the part that was the most amazing about him was how freely he gave all that he had to other people. This guy met me. I was a nobody. Literally, I was an assistant to, first he met me assistant to Whale, and then I became an assistant to Paul. And this guy, from the day he met me until the day he died, took me under his wing. I met Bill Clinton because of him. I met Hillary Clinton because of him. I met Katherine Graham. I mean, you name it. Name people around the world. He would be in meetings. He'd say, hey, where are you? Where are you? I say, I'm at my place. He said, is your man with you? He called my husband my man. I said, yeah, he's in town. And sometimes he wasn't. He says, well, just throw something on and meet me down at the XYZ. What for? He says, don't worry, just come. And you'd walk in and it would be a room full of like the movers and shakers in the world. And he would introduce me to them. His wallet of contacts, of knowledge, of insights was open to me. I could take anything out of it that I wanted. And I try like hell to be like him today. So I had four people who just imagine how powerful they were in their own right. who looked at me and said, yeah, she's worth it. I'll give her access. And it was just amazing. And my husband, by the way, who was a scientist, and he had access inside of Xerox. Kind of, he knew all the corridors and the corners and stuff. And I ended up marrying him. and we stayed married for 30 years until he passed away. But he was another guy who just, no problems, no issues. What do you need? I'll give you a hand. He was just wonderful.
We'll be back in a few minutes with our guest mentor, Teneo Chairwoman Ursula Burns. You can listen to our show worldwide on iHeartRadio or on your favorite podcast platform like Apple or Spotify. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm talking with former Xerox CEO Ursula Burns about her remarkable career. So you mentioned your husband, Lloyd. You recommend to career women to find an older husband. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, that started out to be a joke, but when I thought about it more and more, I realized that it was one of the secrets to myself and my husband's success, if you can call it success. But obviously you can have the same success with a younger husband. My situation was that my husband, by the time I met him, he had already been through the cycle of a young man, meaning the hot cars and the, you know, fancy, whatever the heck it is that are material things. And he was a lot more settled on an impact in the world. It gave me an unbelievable amount of freedom. I had to travel. And he's like, yeah, sure. Let's figure out, you know, where am I going to be for the next 2 weeks? If you have to be in Japan for a week, he was a good cook. He loved cooking. He knew how to clean the house. I knew how to cook and clean the house too. So it was, we walked in as peers, and he had already been through, I think, so much stuff that he was just fine being happy, right? Finding somebody he could be happy with.
You mentioned Japan. You had an international assignment, you know, before you became CEO in London. And reading your book, I think I was in the Netherlands when you were in London. How important do you think an overseas assignment is to somebody to become the best, we'll call it global company CEO they could become?
I think it is absolutely vital. Obviously, many people do it without having the opportunity to do what I did. But I tell you, the perspective, particularly if you're from America, right? America is this big bolus. It's this big thing. Everybody speaks the language that we speak, even though it came from the UK, or wants to. The global financial system, the tech world, movie star. I mean, literally, we're in the center of the world. We have so much here that we can live without ever understanding the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. It was really important. My first long-term stays outside the United States were in Japan, which was unbelievable. I stayed months in Japan. And it was really amazing to see this is a country that's exactly unlike America. Right? It doesn't speak the language, doesn't write the language, eats different foods, looks physically different. Everything about it is different. And it's so important to understand that for them, that is the center of their world. And then when I went to live in the UK, I lived there for almost 4 years. It was absolutely amazing. I spoke the same language, but just about everything else was different. And it was fun. It was really interesting for our kids. And it gave me a base to see the rest of Europe, right? Because UK is close to everything, right? So it gave me the base to see that and made me significantly more confident as an American and as a global citizen, and made me also significantly more respectful of other countries and their natural beings, right? Which are not ours. It's yeah. Just different. And it's important. It's important. So one of the things that we did when we had kids was, fortunately, for some of those years that we were living in the UK, but they have, to the best of our ability, seen a lot of the world and had access to be able to see a lot of the world is so different than America.
Well, I found it very helpful as well, because running a big American company, and you say that the U.S. market's big, you have all these Americans around you, you forget your impact on the rest of the world. And particularly, I find it more recently when, we'll call it, just politics and things that are very uniquely American become more of a consideration. And we'll call it U.S.-based stakeholders, having that global perspective. How are they thinking about this outside the U.S.? And I think also from a governance perspective for those running companies, If you don't have international experience, maybe have some members of the board that come in from outside the U.S. to always have that perspective at the table. We'll be back in a few minutes with Ursula Burns. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and I'm talking with former Xerox CEO Ursula Burns about mentorship. So, Ursula, you almost leave Xerox to go work at Dell. Why did you almost leave? Why did you decide to stay? And what lessons would you have for folks who, let's say, have been with their company for quite a few years and are thinking about leaving? How should they think about it?
Yeah, I was, we've made a leadership change in the company. And by this time, I was a firm part of ascending middle management of the firm. I was running something, a business group or a product team. I had already served as the executive assistant to Paul Allaire. I lived internationally. You know, I was able to pick up the phone and call leaders in the company who were ahead of me, and I knew some board members. All good stuff. So everything was going pretty well. We made a leadership change. We brought in the CEO, and I was running manufacturing. We brought in a CEO who had a different approach to leading. And I didn't particularly care about that. That was fine. I mean, I wasn't in love with any different approach, any specific approach. So a different approach was just fine. But he was not engaging and he didn't listen. Not listening was a big problem. He made it clear that what I did was not important. He said, basically, what you do, there's nothing that you're going to do here that's going to make a difference to the company at the end of the day. He didn't quite say it that way, but that was the exact message. And I remember thinking that if that's the case, I can go someplace that it makes a difference. And I got lots of calls, Dan. I got calls all the time. Come work here, come work there. And I never responded to any of them because I was having a great time where I was. And I was paid well, I thought. And, you know, what difference? I never really worried that much about pay. So it was not a big deal to stay where I was until this time when it became clear to me, clearer and clearer to me that what I was doing was not important to the company. And so I literally got called by Dell. And I went and did the whole scoop, went to Round Rock, the whole thing, looked for a house, found schools for the kids, et cetera, went to the head of HR, his name was Hector Matroni, and told him, I'm leaving. And he said to me, have you called Paul? And I said, no, I called you. You're the head of HR. He says, no, but there's no way you're going to get away with this with me telling him. You have to tell him. And I told Paul, and Paul basically said, you know, if you made up your mind, you know, basically I'll help you. But he obviously didn't stop there. He called Vernon Jordan. Vernon called me, and they flew down to the airport in Rochester. Vernon, another board member named Nick Nicholas, and another one, Ralph Larson, and basically sat on the plane, didn't even get off the plane. I went on the plane and said, Vernon was the one who did all the speaking. He said, you can't leave. He said, this company, I said, well, I'm not that important. Give me a break. I mean, I'm running manufacturing. It's not like I'm running finance. I'm not the CFO. I'm not anything like that. At that point, I knew what a CFO was because before that, I really didn't. He said, the thing that you have that you don't understand and don't realize is that you have this connection with Paul. I had this loyalty to Paul. I liked him. Vernon thought, and everybody thought, if I left, that would be a signal. Vernon's point was, you know, you've made it to where you are based on this company. And so you used it to become Ursula Burns. Now it needs you. You literally have to stay. He said, you can't leave because you would be abandoning. He says, it's like having an old husband. You find this new, this is what he said. You find this new sexy guy, you run off with the guy, even though the old guy is you built your life with him. He said, you literally, you can't go. He would be personally offended if I went. By the way, his being personally offended was a big deal, but it wouldn't have kept me there alone. I did go home and think about it. I talked to my husband about it as well. And he was exactly where Paul was and where Vernon was, which is Yeah, I'll go wherever, you know, fine. I'll go to Round Rock if in Texas, if that's where you want to go, even though Texas is not a state that we necessarily love. But I'll go there, fine. But more importantly, what would happen to the company if you left? Just give it a couple of more bats or swings at the bat and see if you can really make a difference here. I stayed. I called Dell, Michael Dell, and said, I'm sorry. And he said, and this is what I say in the book, I so respect him to this day. He said, no problem. I get it. I understand what you're doing. And, you know, if you ever need anything, give me a call. So, and I stayed, and the rest, as I say, is history. It was a tough, tough swing. We eventually, the new CEO and us eventually separated. Paul came back as the CEO. Then we brought Ann in as the president. She ended up becoming the CEO. I became the head of the internal operations of the company. By this time, we were really bleeding cash and had a lot of trouble. But it was probably the best experience from a business perspective, the best experience in business that you can have in managing people through trauma of like rewriting yourself, taking big risks. Communications was huge. It was just a great experience. It would have been great if we didn't have to go through it. But if you have to go through it, doing what we did was the best teacher. Today I am well thought of in business generally because of that time. And was at the center of it.
By the way, one of the things you said in your book in terms of deciding whether to stay or leave, really ask yourself, are you running away from something or are you running towards something? And I've done both. And I will say from my own experience in looking back on the one where I ran from something, even though it was perhaps the best thing for me, I always felt a sense of guilt because the people I left behind were worse off.
Worse off, exactly. And it was one of the best. Thank you for bringing that up. I use that a lot. I use that a lot in personal life. I use it a lot in work as well, because it doesn't really necessarily change your decision, but you have to know when you're running away from something, where you're going may not solve the problem. Where you're going probably has nothing to do with what happened behind. You have to make sure that if you are going to leave, that you're going to the place you're going to for the right reason.
Do you believe that the CEO's role is to serve a wide constituency of stakeholders or just the shareholders? And if it's the former, does that make the CEO's job a lot more difficult and complex?
I have always believed. Maybe I was a little bit ahead of my time, but I don't think so. I think a lot of CEOs are there too. I've always believed it's various stakeholders. This idea that you can run my daughter can run a company if all she has to do is do math every day and have the highest number at the end of every quarter come out. She's good at math. My son is really good at math too. That's not what we do for a living. What we do for a living is we have to secure and solidify the license to operate in the communities that we operate in and in the world. The license to operate is, obviously you have to be a viable business that makes reasonable money, as much reasonable money as possible. You have to be a viable member of society. You can't literally pollute the world and pay people too little so they become wards of the state. You literally have to have a point of view about education and education process. If that's not the case, we have 800 million employees people employing around developed countries. And if you're silent about all of the things that have to do with them, well, we know what happens, right? We had children in sweatshops. We had enslaved people working. If all we have to do is make the most money possible, it's the easiest job out. It's the easiest job out. We can all do this. We can pay our people the least amount of money possible. Don't give them great health care. People who actually advocate for that, I wouldn't want to live in a world that advocated for that. So I think that it's never been that way. We got ourselves confused for a while about the most money possible. And we got ourselves confused and unfortunately enacted law that made it possible for us to ignore things that we're dealing with today. A relatively undereducated population, an unbelievably tenuous relationship with the earth that we live on today, that we have to start doing things that repair some of the damage that we've done over time, not because we are tree huggers, but because it's falling apart. If we don't fix this problem, we're counting down how long we're going to be able to sustain life as we know it. It's never been about one stakeholder called a shareholder. It has never been. And I was so happy when I was on the Business Roundtable, right when I was leaving the Business Roundtable, they actually put out their ethos that literally this is about many stakeholders, not about the shareholder only. And anybody, I would not invest in a company that I could see visibly that they were trying to make me devoid of everything else the most money. I get really worked up on this one, really worked up.
Well, it's one of the reasons I serve on the board of Just Capital, a nonprofit, because it's about the positive role that that companies can play if they serve all stakeholders well. Okay. And quite frankly, the results show that those companies that serve all stakeholders well do the best for shareholders too. So we'll be back in a few minutes with Ursula Burns. You'll find all of our show notes and links at thementorsradio.com. For those who listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or on one of the many podcast platforms that carry our show, if you enjoy these conversations, please give us a good review and tell a friend. This is Dan Hesse, and this is The Mentors Radio.
And now, back to The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business.
Welcome back. This is Dan Hesse, and we are with legendary businesswoman Ursula Burns discussing success and happiness. So, Ursula, how do you define success?
Leaving behind more than you take away. Achieving what you set out to achieve, whatever that is, and doing it in such a way that you don't scrape away the surface of anything, you know, leave it less than it was when you walked in the door. I think a lot of people, and for a while, not very long, but for a while in my life, I thought success had more to do with numbers. Like, you know, many people manage, lots of money made, whatever the heck it is. The number of awards, degrees behind your name, awards that you've been awarded. And I found out through experience, a lot of it through my mother and looking back at her life, at how successful she was. So doing what you want to do and leaving behind more than you take away.
So how do you define happiness?
That's a little bit harder. First for me is that I have, that my kids are happy. This is going to sound crazy, but I have two children and I cannot believe how my joy, comfort, everything can swing with their joy, comfort, and everything. So first is that since I produced these two children, that with my husband, that they are happy and settled, that they are comfortable. And these kids work hard. I mean, this isn't comfortable is my mother's definition of comfortable, which is you got to work for it, hustle for it. But happiness for me has to do with having calmness. It's hustling and working hard. But it's also the people that I love, kind of, I can look at the room and the people that I love and say they're all set and settled and more likely to do the right thing than the wrong thing in a day and definitely settled in their lives in a positive way. Happiness is one of these things. I read a lot. I'm a big, big, I'm a ferocious reader. And I'm reading a book now called Corrections by James Franzen. I read it once before reading it again. And it's just, it's a book about a family. It's like nothing. It's just about a family. And this family is not a happy family. I can tell you what that looks like more than I can tell you what a happy family looks like. And I think if you see our happy individual, and if you see my life, most of the time in my tight circle, I'm relatively happy. The part that troubles me now and is definitely grading away at it is the state of the world. I think, you know, there's always trouble in the world. From the time I was born during Vietnam, right? The tail end of Vietnam and grew up during that time. And that was clearly not the best time in the world at all. But I would have thought by now we would have figured out certain things that we would never do again. You know, these crazy wars that are just like massive, you know, things where, you know, we put all these people in these uniforms, we give them guns and they go march into other countries and basically hunt out people to kill them. I thought we were over. I know that we're not over it, but you just think it would be less happening less. So anyway, I'm a little bit of a ramble. I think happiness for me is just having the people who are around me, closest to me, settled and on the right path. And I don't hope for that much more, even though I wish for more. You know, I think that's the most I can do right now.
So I know you're a really hard worker. You like to stay very, very busy. And you're a reader. Other than reading, what do you do for fun?
I love walking and biking. And the interesting thing about walking, and this is one of my newest passions, is that it forces me to slow down a bit and to think. I never listen to, I love music as well. I love music. I love concerts. And all unfortunately, my concerts are for people who are so old. Most people, I still want to go, you know, Bruce Springsteen, Sting. These are like the old guys, right? I love them. And so I have a group of girlfriends that we go and try to find the concerts, and we go to crazy places. We go to Amsterdam to see a concert. We'll go to Vegas, that kind of thing. So I love music. I love reading. I love walking. I love hanging out with my good friends. I really like being in a quiet place. I really like. So I have a place in London, and I have a place in Florida, even though I'm not proud of the place in Florida because it's not one of my favorite states, but it's a good tax arrangement. And one of the things I love about both places is that I can go in my house and not leave for 2 or 3 days, and I can just literally hang out inside. I love quiet. I'm a little bit of a loner, so I don't really, you know, hang out a lot. I just like being calm and thinking, nothing too. I don't like dressing up, you know, like this ball gown stuff. I really just like being by myself with my good friends. Maybe that's when you're 65.
Well, you know, in that, you know, kind of following up in that spirit, my two college roommates, one living in Delaware, another one lives in Washington State. They're flying into Phoenix in a few weeks, and we're going to go see Neil Young together.
I love Neil Young. My goodness gracious.
He's terrific. Well, Ursula, your story of rising from New York City's tenements to the top of the corporate world is really inspiring, and we appreciate you sharing, you know, your journey, the lessons learned, and kind of thank you for all you do to try to make this country a better place for all Americans. To our listeners, please go to thementorsradio.com for show notes and other resources. You can also listen to us on the major podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple, and on iHeartRadio worldwide. Please join us next week for another edition of The Mentors Radio. Until then, this is Dan Hesse signing off. Remember, we're never too informed or experienced to stop learning.
It's been The Mentors, where remarkable CEOs challenge your thinking about life and business. To get more information about the program or a sponsor, to download a podcast of today's show, or to leave a question for our host, go to thementorsradio.com. That's www.thementorsradio.com. The preceding program, copyright CBJ LLC. All rights reserved.